Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is the Friday Roundtable. This hour, what the mad scientist and the monster have to tell us 2 centuries later.
You have created a monster and it will destroy you.
Patience, patience. I believe in this monster, as you call it. And if you don't, well, you must leave me alone.
But think of Elizabeth, your father.
Elizabeth believes in me. My father never believes in anyone. I've got to experiment further. He's only a few days old, remember. So far, he's been kept in complete darkness. Wait till I bring him into the light. Here he comes. Let's turn up the light.
That's Hollywood's version of Frankenstein, and the films often give short shrift to the urgent questions Mary Shelley raised in her novel, published in January of 1818. But before we delve into those questions for the roundtable, think about this. Mary Shelley was a 20-year-old literary novice whose name wasn't even put on the cover of the book, and yet her novel, Frankenstein or the Modern Prometheus, is a novel that still has relevant things to say 2 centuries later. There have been more than 70 movies, an opera, a ballet, many, many academic treatments of the novel, and think how extraordinary that is. Today, we're going to consider the questions that Shelley raises from our contemporary sensibility, and I'd like to hear from you on Twitter about it. How do you view the meaning of Dr. Frankenstein's monster? What is the scientist and his creation telling us about the world we live in today? Especially like to hear from you if you're a scientist. I'd love to have your view on that. Tweet me at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our roundtablers today, Jennifer Alexander is Director of Graduate Studies in the History of Science, Tech, and Medicine at the University of Minnesota. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Good to be here.
Heidi Berg is an actor for Green Tea Production Company. Heidi, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Juliet Berba is Director of Exhibits and Collections at the Bakken Museum. And Juliet, welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Tell me a little bit about what the exhibit shows us, because I think people ought to go over and see it.
The exhibit is about Mary Shelley, author of Frankenstein. The Bakken has had a long-standing relationship with the Frankenstein story because of our founder, Earl Bakken, who found inspiration in that story. And so we've had this long-standing relationship. We've had collections related to Frankenstein, and we decided to bring her story out. I think a lot of people in the Twin Cities have seen the Frankenstein story there. It's kind of been a beloved thing there. And we really wanted to tell the story behind that, the story of the woman behind that, who was really a teenager, 18, when she started writing that book.
And Jennifer, I mean, that's the thing that I wanted to emphasize. You have your copy of Frankenstein with you today.
I do. Good. I'm one of many copies.
Notice that. Good. I think that is so extraordinary. She was a teenager when she started to write it, quite young when it was published. Mm-hmm. No name on the cover, and we're still talking about it 2 centuries. How do you account for that?
It's a great story. It's just a really great story. And one of the things that's most fascinating about it is that the creature at the center of the story is really the most sympathetic character, I think, in the entire novel. And it's a surprise when he starts to speak. It's a surprise, the story he tells of educating himself, of trying to figure out the world. And he's been abandoned, essentially, by the doctor, by Frankenstein. He's been abandoned. And how he raises himself and engages with the world. And how he's so desperately lonely. And how he realizes, slowly, he realizes how ugly he is. He doesn't realize this till he sees his reflection in some water. He doesn't realize how ugly he is. And he so desperately desires companionship, and he cannot find it. And so I think that center core is just such a gripping story. And when you finally get to the creature telling his own story, it really carries you along. My students read it. We read it almost every year. Not every time. Every year do I teach it, but I often do. And they like it.
Your point is really well taken. I mean, the description of the monster, Heidi, shriveled skin, you know, this terrible color, to have the reality of that be converted into the character that we are most sympathetic with is an extraordinary accomplishment by Mary Shelley. How do you read it?
It is an accomplishment. I think the most compelling part about this is one of the most compelling parts about any story with a central monster, The truth in most of them is that the monster is a human, versus the one we're supposed to look at as this terrible creature. Guillermo del Toro does a wonderful job of pointing that out in his work.
Including The Shape of Water.
Shape of Water.
Yeah.
You definitely see this. And I think that that version of that perspective on the human cruelty and the human baser instincts not necessarily being handed off to their creation or to what they encounter, merely their misunderstanding, is compelling. And I mean, I'm not going to lie. When I first read it as a young girl, I was so angry at the doctor. For his shallowness. It reflected in people I knew around me. I related to it so directly. It was personal. It was personal. It took me a long time and to be able to see his side of it at all. I was 100% pro-creature.
From the beginning. Has anybody else seen The Shape of Water, by the way, just before? Heidi, I just want to say, I made a note to myself after seeing the movie recently. I think Frankenstein and Del Toro are asking similar questions about what our traditional ideas of normal are and how hard it is for a culture that's really invested in the idea of normal to understand new ideas, I guess, about that. How would you put it?
I think that's a really good way to put it. I think an interesting aspect to it is that we are also obsessed with the individual.
Yeah.
So it's very important to be normal, excuse me, and to blend in and to be one of everybody, but you need to stand out somehow. And yet the people who truly stand out, we villainize, we make them into monsters. And sometimes you see their genius later. Today, I am reminded of the passing of David Bowie, who is another man who was villainized, especially in his youth, and has come to be respected for the musical genius he is. He was unique. He did not blend in. We're supposed to blend in. We're supposed to be special, but we're not supposed to take that extra step.
Julia?
I think this is something that gets lost when people are only familiar with this story through maybe I think the most famous version is probably that 1931 movie.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But even all the other pop culture Frankensteins that are out there, people don't see that. That's I think one of the most compelling things about that novel is how complex really all of those characters are. All of those characters have their good sides and their bad sides. They do good things and they do terrible things. And this is really lost if people don't read the book. And in that regard, I really encourage everyone. I know that there's been a push this year, I think particularly this winter, to get everyone around the country reading this book. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a great idea. It's something that gets lost.
Jennifer, do most of your students come to reading the book thinking that the monster is Frankenstein?
Yes, that's really common.
Why?
Well, that's actually a really good question. And I don't know why. The book is called Frankenstein and the Monster is the most recognizable. I'll call him the creature. I think that's a little bit nicer.
is
the most recognizable of the characters if you don't know what's going on. So they just get associated together. But there is something about the creature that is worth saying, though. The creature is a threat. The creature is a threat. So in a way, his uncanny appearance does give some evidence of what he ends up being capable of. He isn't, in the end, a nice guy.
No, he certainly does terrible things in the novel.
Mm-hmm. Is he a threat also because he's so much more than just the one-dimensional monster creature that I guess you would expect before you read the novel? Yes?
That's an interesting question. And I think he is a threat because he threatens the order of what we know about life and death.
Yes.
He was raised from the dead. He was resurrected. And that is a threat to the natural order.
Mm-hmm. He's new. He's entirely new. And in addition to that, he is a threat. He has the potential to be profoundly dangerous, but he's created. He's abandoned. He's left to his own devices, to find his own way. He's, as was said earlier, profoundly lonely, profoundly misunderstood, beaten, chased off, attacked.
Dog set on him.
And he's created as a monster by the people around him. Mm-hmm. He is made as the creature with potential, like we all have.
I've often wondered what Dr. Frankenstein thought he would create. Have you ever contemplated that?
He says quite clearly he wanted to create something beautiful. And
But he was reanimating a corpse.
Well, not a corpse. It's even worse than that. A bunch of scraps.
That's right. Exactly right.
So it's not. But he chose the most beautiful dimensions and the most beautiful of those scraps he could find in the charnel houses. And he thought it was going to be a beautiful creation, but then its yellow eye opened and it looked grizzled and awful, and he ran away. So he thought it was ugly. The minute it was animated, the minute he gave it that spark of life, he assembled the instruments of life and he gave it a spark. The minute then its eye opened and it began to breathe, he realized he'd made something hideous.
And I think this is really Mary Shelley's commentary on ambition and the limits of ambition, that it can really be taken too far. And certainly she was commenting on a lot that was going around her. She was commenting on science at the time. She was commenting on, I think, on the men who were around her who were very ambitious. So there's a lot that's going on underneath that story. There was a lot going on in young Mary Shelley's life that really feeds into that and became this complex commentary.
Julia, when you say the men around her, do you mean the fact that she is in Geneva with this group of male friends, specifically that, or the men in a broader sense in her life?
Well, I think both. I think certainly the context being in Geneva, where she first had the idea, where she was with Percy Shelley, who was an
married
ambitious,
at the time.
Yeah, and yes, married at the time.
But was her lover, would become her husband.
But
yes.
There with her, and Lord Byron. So two ambitious and famous writers. People who were seen as kind of rock stars at the time.
And a doctor.
And a doctor, Polidori, yes. Mm-hmm. The sort of, he was kind of the origin of the Dracula story, some say. But then also other men, her father, who was a large presence in her life as well. So I think in that regard, both the specific context and then more broadly.
Well, and I think too that the doctor wanted to not just create something beautiful, but there was a profound ego attached to it. He wanted to create an entire race
of beings that
would owe their existence to him.
Right.
So there, and I think that feeds in really nicely to what you were just saying about the men in her life. She had a very complex relationship with her father. They were very close when she was young. Her mother died before she had an opportunity, 11 days old, before she had an opportunity to know her at all. So she was kept alive for her by her father in a book he wrote, which then scandalized the whole family. And in the first several years of her life, a very close relationship with him until the stepmother came into the picture and he sort of washed his hands of child rearing. And that abandonment, I mean, the more you look at the stories of Mary Shelley and also her mother, Mary Wollstonecraft, you see a lot of parallels to her choice for the journey of both the doctor and the creature.
How important is it that this book is also being published in a time when observational and experimental science is starting to be a bit better understood, Jennifer? Is it 1818? What does the scientific world look like at that point?
Well, people are interested in electricity, and so certainly is Victor Frankenstein. And one of the things that historians have been interested in is the relationship really with medical science at the time that Mary Shelley was writing. And people in her circles, Percy Shelley's
physician was actually involved in a debate at the London College of Surgeons about what is the nature really of living organisms and life. And on the one hand was someone saying, Abernathy was his name, saying there's something subtle. There's some kind of subtle fluid, subtle substance that's like the soul. It's analogous to the soul. And it's what provides animation. And the other fellow, Lewis, was saying, no, it's all mechanical, really. We can just figure it out and stitch things together, and we can understand things mechanically. So this debate is going on in 1816, 1817, 1818, right, as she's writing this and thinking about these questions. And electricity is a weird thing. I keep looking at Juliet, you know, the Bacchanist is dedicated to electricity and life. And it's a really odd thing. So there have been experiments. I think the book itself references not specifically, I don't think it says Benjamin Franklin, but it talks about a kite being used to draw down electricity from the clouds and how disappointing this was to the young Victor when he saw that it could be controlled in a way. He wanted it to be some kind of wild force. And there's a real tension when Victor is beginning to his studies. He has a youthful interest in really old, outdated science, Cornelius Agrippa, Paracelsus, who has the best name ever known to humankind, Theophrastus Bombastus von Hohenheim, who was this Swiss physician and alchemist, and Albertus Magnus, who was medieval, writing about mysteries and magic. And so this is what the youthful Victor, as Mary Shelley describes him, was so fascinated by and so disappointed when he saw the new instruments of the new instrumental science, because they didn't have the grandeur that he wanted.
Juliet, Jennifer reminds me that the mystery of electricity is kind of missing from our lives, right? We flip a light switch. I don't think very much about how this happens, but it was alive and vivid, I think, in this time.
It certainly was. Interestingly, in the first edition of the book, there is this reference that Jennifer mentioned about seeing the power of electricity, that Victor sees this power, but it doesn't explicitly connect this to resurrecting the monster. Mm-hmm. What she says is that she infused it with the spark of being. And what the question is what was the spark of being? And I think a lot of people assume that this was electricity. And it was later, in a later edition, that she hints at this, that she says galvanism, which is her way of referring to electricity, had given token of such things, that this might be possible. She said this in an introduction. Electricity was a fascination. There were some really terrible, frightening experiments that were being conducted. There were experiments on corpses, well, on animals, and she may have seen something like that, because these were things that were done at public demonstrations. There was also, in 1803, there was an experiment where a scientist from Italy had come, Aldini, and he had done this on the corpse of an executed criminal. He had applied electricity and showed how it could affect the body of this dead body, how it could affect the limbs, affect the muscles of the face, and so that it would appear to move. It would appear that life had maybe been restored to this. So this experiment happened. It was in the newspapers. It was in 1803. Mary was very young. She wouldn't have seen this. But her father, who had friends over all the time to talk about all kinds of topics, he had a friend, Carlyle, who was probably there and probably witnessed this. And Mary, the young Mary, would hide where she could in the room to overhear the conversation. And so there's a good chance that she heard about this. And you can imagine, being young, she would have been, about 6 years old?
The impression that yes. would have made?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes.
Right. Not knowing really how to process the scientific information. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. It would seem terrifying. I mean, that is the kind of thing that would stick with you.
For sure. You're listening to a Friday roundtable where we're contemplating Frankenstein, exhibit at the Bakken, 200 years old. This published in 1818, in January of 1818. By, as I noted in the introduction, this young woman, she was 20 when it was published, a teenager when she wrote it, a literary novice. We're reading the novel two centuries later, and there's a lot to talk about from a literary sense, from a scientific sense, and that's what we're doing on the roundtable today with Juliet Burba. She's director of exhibits and collections at the Bakken Museum. Heidi Berg is with us, actor for Green Tea Production Company, and Jennifer Alexander here, director of graduate studies in the history of science, technology, and medicine at the University of Minnesota. I'd like to hear from you, especially if you come out of the scientific field. How do you view the meaning of Dr. Frankenstein's monster and what, or creature, as we're calling him? What is the scientist and his creation telling us about the world? You can talk to me about it on Twitter. It's at CarrieMPR. I wanted to, I'm sure you all know this, but I thought this was interesting to note that Mary Shelley would write in a preface to a later edition that she'd had a dream of the creature. And this is how she saw it in the dream. "I saw the pale student of unhallowed arts kneeling beside the thing he had put together. I saw the hideous phantasm of a man stretched out, and then on the working of some powerful engine show signs of life. He sleeps, but he is awakened. He opens his eyes. Behold, the horrid thing stands at his bedside, opening his curtains and looking on him with yellow, watery, but speculative eyes." What do you hear in that, Heidi, that description?
Oh, so much. There's a lot of fear, obviously, that, right, that she's talking about. When you see things like that in a dream, what are you afraid of? There's success in that. And mm-hmm. fear of success is a mm-hmm. profound fear we carry with us every day. And I hear the unintended consequences, if you will, of our actions. Here was this scientist, this doctor, bringing something to life, and it turns out to be not what he expected. Mm-hmm. And without the openness to accept that this was not what he expected and still try to find out what it is, we end up with a monster standing over our beds instead of an understanding of something new.
I think this is so relevant to a conversation I'm going to have next week with Jeff Kahn, who used to be at the University of Minnesota. He's now at Johns Hopkins, and I'm going to be in Baltimore next week, and so he's going to do the show. It's even today, we're going to talk about gene editing. Mm-hmm. And even today, his role and other ethicists' roles is to say, is the science getting ahead of the ethics of it? And we're still wrestling mm-hmm. with that. Mm-hmm. Yes, and uncomfortable around it. Jennifer, go ahead.
Well, we are still wrestling with that. We really continue to wrestle with it. We want science to be good. We depend on it for so many things in our lives, for so many things that have made our cities livable and our lives less miserable or even more joyful. We depend on it for so many things. But we just don't know what we're capable of. And the Frankenstein story has, well, you see it in Frankenfoods, for example. This is the European concern about genetically modified organisms appearing in food and whether or not we have adequate control over what can be done or can't be done to our food supply. So the word Frankenstein and Frankenfood shows up there. Or it was a debate in the 70s into the 80s, the recombinant DNA debate, our DNA, that it might escape down the sink, down the drain of a sink from a laboratory and begin to replicate itself in the wild and do heaven knows what. So there's enormous worry and fear. And it's not an unusual thing for power to outstrip ability to understand. This is the case even in human development. And we see this in the creature, too. He doesn't realize how powerful he is and what he can do, and he ends up killing a small child simply wanting to play with the child. He doesn't understand that. And so sometimes science seems, we have ideas for science and hopes for science that are beyond what we really feel like we can control. And there's one thing that the Mary Shelley story, I think, is helpful for thinking about in terms of scientific work and technological work, really, in particular, because what we know, something was built, right? We don't know what the theory is behind it. We don't know even what really the science might have been that Frankenstein was doing, but we do know something was built. Is working in isolation. We were having a conversation, Heidi, as we were waiting to come in this morning, about Frankenstein and you portraying the doctor this way, mm-hmm. being isolated and really ill and in pain. And so he has this marvelous discovery of where life comes from, but he doesn't tell anybody about it. He doesn't tell anybody about it. He keeps it completely secret. And then he creates the monster. He's horrified. He runs away and goes to bed and gets sick. And then he goes off to college and he's away for 6 years. He abandons that creature. He doesn't follow through the responsibility of what it was that he, with the responsibility of what he had created. He just didn't follow through. He was ill.
Heidi, will you speak to the isolation part of this? I hadn't thought this through.
Oh, absolutely. The context in which it came up was, as I said earlier, I am absolutely 100% pro-creature. And I always had trouble with the doctor. I didn't enjoy his shallowness. I obviously appreciated the genius, but the cowardice. And, I mean, so many things that my young mind went to rail against him. And it wasn't until I got a little bit older and had an isolating experience of my own wherein my father died. And my father was a hero to me in many ways and a support and a dear, dear friend. And when he died, I recognized my mourning as my mourning. You get to mourn too. My mom is mourning in her own way. My sister mourns in her own way. My husband mourns in his own way. But my mourning is my mourning. And I went inside with that, and it was very selfish, and it was very self-centered. And when I looked back at the doctor the next time I read the book, he had just lost his mother. And then he goes and dives into science, and then he finds this thing, and it's all for him. It's all internal. He's very isolated in his mourning, and then in his intelligence, and then in his ego. And it's so easy to understand when you see it through that lens. Mm-hmm. But absolutely, that is what he does. Had any of his friends at school or anybody, any of his friends from home known what he was doing, there would have been a chance for a balance. There would have been a chance for somebody to say, okay, Victor, you go over there. I'm going to deal with this for now. When you come back, we'll partner again. You know, for him to have that breakdown and run away and still not have it have such dire consequences.
It also reminds me, the way you tell that, how unnatural it is. If you were in an experiment like this and you believe that you were creating something wholly new, it is somewhat unnatural to keep that completely to yourself and not share the power and the beauty of that, isn't it? What does that tell us?
I think it's absolutely unnatural, and it suggests that he maybe already knew that.
Yes.
Victor already knew that he had done something that he shouldn't. But I also think I know I've gone back to this theme a few times, but I think it also shows Mary Shelley's brilliance in commenting on what was around her,
mm-hmm.
and on this idea that geniuses work in isolation, and that this is an idea at that time, mm-hmm. that the genius works in isolation.
Don't we still believe that in some ways?
I think we do.
Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah,
that's
a misunderstanding about genius.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead,
mm-hmm.
Julie.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. We do still believe that, and I think to Jennifer's point, this commentary on isolation, and in particular as it relates to science, is really important. And that's, I think, part of why this book still really resonates with us today, is in looking at science now, there's certainly a push to have the public engaged, to really be thinking about responsibility, to be thinking about how do we do science, how do we innovate responsibly. And how can we engage the public in this so that it isn't this kind of one-directional process?
I want to come back to the genius idea, this too, the isolation around that. But Jennifer, in some ways I think we, the lay people who are not the scientists, believe there's this inevitable push for scientific knowledge, and it's very difficult to get ahead of that. And I guess maybe that's the tension with that. A lot of people are uncomfortable with these new fields that science is pushing into. But I think we also have it feels inevitable in some ways that we can't really get our arms around it to stop it, because science will eventually know. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying. And the program I'm in is History of Science, Technology, and Medicine. I'm really a historian of technology. So I would say we may talk about science in these terms, trying to understand it and trying to keep it within our grasp in
yes.
a way. But it has a life of its own. It seems to me that more and more it's technology, really, that is in that position.
Yes.
More than the underlying
Absolutely.
Idea of science. And science is more and more devoted toward trying to produce something that has a tangible effect and not just pure knowledge. And this has been a struggle and debates back and forth in scientific and political circles for a century, more than a century. The sense that it can outrun us and the inevitability, there is a real fatalism. I notice this among my students. So I teach undergraduate and graduate students. And I notice this in the undergraduates often when they first start looking at the history of technology, it's very hard to suggest to them that things didn't have a path that they were already set on. You know, that, you know, there was a railroad, voila, we've conquered the West. There's a sense that technology drives society. And this is something historians struggle with all the time, because if technology drives society, who cares about the history? Let's just figure out, you know, what's going on right now and what comes next. It's a real issue. And we talk about it in my classes in terms of telephones. Who has their phone? What do you feel like when you don't have your phone? And how much money it costs you to have the phone? And how much money we generate, all of us, by having the phone? And I am delighted with my phone. No, I set up, I had my husband and my son texting me this morning because I'm involved in something very exciting, and I was afraid I was going to not get on the light rail in time to get here, right? So I love that phone. I love that kind of connection. But it does, in a way, direct a lot of our relationships and how we organize them.
I'm really glad you mentioned technology. I mean, you think about the fatalism around the privacy issue.
Oh, yes, there you go.
And how most of us react, well, what can I do? It's the price we pay having the technology in our pocket, right?
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
I think we've gotten used to that.
Well, and how interesting is it, too, that we have, while it's not predetermined, we have been talking about, or at least people were talking about, technology able to do these things in your pocket.
Right.
Nikola Tesla talked about how he'd be able to be on a boat in the middle of the ocean and take something out of your pocket and read a newspaper from anywhere in the world. So this isn't, the ideas aren't new. What I think is fascinating is how we go chasing after these ideas. Mm-hmm. And sometimes our discoveries and our changes that technology and science both make are steps. And the general public and people who don't understand what you're doing in a scientific setting are comfortable with steps. It's when we make these big jumps that we can't easily understand. Now, if that big jump really benefits me, like we went from, you know, a dumb phone to a smartphone, and that super benefits me, so A plus to that big jump. But if it's a jump that we're not as sure about, can we in fact 3D print
an organ or a gun?
Yeah.
Or, yeah.
And have it be something we can put into a human body and work. Well, now we start to have questions about what are the ramifications, and that's where the talks about ethics come into play. But the entire conversation, we have to look at not the ethics necessarily of the science or the technology, but the ethics of the people. It's an overarching perspective. Mm-hmm. The science and the technology don't have ethics. The people using them, like our good doctor, have the ethics. And he's not a very good doctor, but, you know, they have the ethics. It's their ethics we need to be talking about and concerned with. And the culture drives that. The culture states who we're supposed to be, how we're supposed to be. There were times when religion was a big factor for a lot of people in determining what that is. Now we have a mixed bag and multiple religions in this country and multiple levels of engagement with that. And so it's maybe less of a unified driving force than it once was. So now we need to talk ethics because they're right, not because they're prescribed.
You're listening to a Friday Roundtable. It's a conversation and contemplation of Frankenstein 2 centuries after it was published, January of 1818. We'll get a look at the latest news, and when we come back, we'll hear a reading from the text of Frankenstein.
Good morning. I'm Phil Picardi in the NPR newsroom. President Trump is insisting he never said anything derogatory about Haitians. Trump reacted on Twitter after news outlets reported he asked in a closed-door meeting why the U.S. would accept more immigrants from Haiti and in Africa, referring to those countries with a crude term rather than places like Norway. Trump tweets, "Never said anything derogatory about Haitians other than Haiti is obviously a very poor and troubled country." A senator who was present at a White House immigration meeting yesterday says Trump indeed used vulgar language to describe African countries, saying he said these hate-filled things and he said them repeatedly. Illinois Democrat Dick Durbin told reporters Trump questioned why the U.S. would accept more immigrants from Haiti and that he used the crude term that has been attributed to him. Southern California authorities say the number of people missing since debris-laden flash floods smashed through the community of Montecito is now down to 5, down from as many as 43 a day earlier. Santa Barbara County spokeswoman Amber Anderson released the latest number earlier today. Anderson says the number dropped because people were located, but it could continue to fluctuate greatly. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is nearing 10:42.
Programming supported by Borton Overseas, launching the next Antarctica Signature Journey in March 2019. Discover the hidden wonders of Antarctica, guided by the director of the World Ocean Observatory. Learn more about an exclusive opportunity expiring January 31st at bortonoverseas.com/NPR.
A unique way to show your support for NPR News could be parked in your driveway. Donate your vehicle and transform it into the programming you love. Get your donation rolling at npr.org/vehicle.
Programming is supported by the American Swedish Institute, the only castle in the Twin Cities. Stop by to dine at Fika Cafe, browse the museum store, and explore the historic Turnblad Mansion. More at americanswedishinstitute.org.
I'm Tom Weber. Coming up on NPR News, I'll speak with two women who are in tech, and they'll be discussing what's being done and what should be done for women pursuing careers in technology. There's still a big gender gap in those professions. I hope you'll join us as well at 11.
And you're tuned to Minnesota Public Radio News. We've got very cold weather outside. It's going to be cold all day, mostly cloudy in the far southwest. Sunshine elsewhere, but highs from 10 below zero in the northwest to 5 above zero in the southeast. Tonight, mostly clear skies, low temperatures from 30 to 25 below zero in the north, 15 to 10 below zero in the south. Tomorrow, sunshine, still cold, high temperatures 5 below to 5 above zero. Right now, minus 8 in the Twin Cities.
After days and nights of incredible labor and fatigue, I succeeded in discovering the cause of generation and life. Nay, more, I became myself capable of bestowing animation upon lifeless matter.
That was the audio version of Frankenstein or the Modern Prometheus, a reading from George Guidall. You're the actor here, Heidi. What do you make
Guilty.
Of the reading? Short, but...
It's short, and I think it's, as with any good reading of a book, it imbues it with some of the fatigue and some of the truth of that moment. I think that particular piece of the story is mm-hmm. so pivotal for our doctor, the moment of realization and the moment that he goes into his hibernative state, to his isolation. Mm-hmm. It's a point upon which the story. It's a pinhead. It's so important to think about what would any of us do in that moment.
You're listening to a Friday roundtable of a contemplation of Frankenstein, published in January of 1818, still discussed, still strikingly relevant 2 centuries later. There's an exhibit at the Bakken right now, and an event where our roundtable is Juliet Burba, director of exhibits and collections at the Bakken, Heidi Berg, an actor for Green Tea Production Company, and Jennifer Alexander, director of grad studies in the history of science, technology, and medicine at the University of Minnesota. So tomorrow there's an event, Juliet, at the Bakken. Around Frankenstein.
Indeed. So we have the exhibit that is ongoing, but tomorrow we'll be having an event celebrating the novel, the 200-year anniversary of this novel. So we'll be having all kinds of activities. The Bakken has been working with Arizona State University on an NSF-funded project to explore questions as they relate to Frankenstein, explore questions like what is life? why do we create and what is the responsibility of the creator? And so people can come to the Bakken between 10:30 and 3:30 and engage in all kinds of fun activities that delve into these very deep questions.
Who and how are you representing the creature?
We have a wonderful actor who has represented the creature for several years now.
Okay.
And he happens to be quite tall, so it's quite effective.
So how do you make sure that he, you know, that it isn't sticky? You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. That the focus isn't on the horror of the way.
Yes.
Which I think goes back to Hollywood, I don't think has done us real favors in understanding this novel. So how do you avoid that?
I'm not sure we entirely do. Our, okay. Our Frankenstein is green. but we also have Mary Shelley, and there will be two performances of a one-woman play which we have Mary Shelley talking about the birth of her creature.
That is great. All right. That's really good. Yeah. So, Heidi, I saw you kind of nodding in agreement when I said Hollywood has done us no favors. Where have the movies gone wrong?
They have very little relationship to the book. It was where they normally go wrong in Hollywood. In the 1931 movie, the biggest misstep, and there are many, but the biggest is the blaming of the creature's behavior and the creation of the creature as a monster on an abnormal brain or a brain of an already evil person.
Right.
Which
that
is,
he was born evil.
Born evil, right. Which is, of course, ridiculous and not at all what Mary was saying. Not mm-hmm. they just left the novel behind in the interest of making something that could tell a fascinating story that would thrill and terrify, as opposed to actually tap into the stories that and the important things she was trying to get across with the novel, in my opinion.
Does anyone here think there is a good film representation of it? No?
I haven't seen one. No.
It's been a while since I've seen, isn't there one with Robert De Niro? And it's been a while since I've seen that. So
it's closer. Come. It pays more of a, it owes more of its story to the book, certainly. But the creature doesn't.
He's not sympathetic.
He's not sympathetic still, which is what is missing. And it's that sympathy that we have for the creature that allows us to become better people after reading the book. Mm-hmm. Insight, seeing ourselves in something that is other than ourselves and is hated and loathed. And it gives us empathy for those things that others might be hating and loathing for reasons that pass understanding to us. It opens our empathy channels. And without that, it's just not the story. It's just not the book.
It's just a monster story.
Just a monster right. story.
I think you have to go to theater to get good representations. I know that there was a production that Danny Boyle directed that was the National Theatre in London.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that, just the birth scene alone was incredible.
There have been some incredible manifestations on stage, and I think partly that's due to the fact that on stage we're accustomed to telling a story without showing you the inner workings of the machine.
Yeah.
But on film, people seem to demand that interest. And so if we can't show you how this creature was brought to life, we're going to just show you a big, scary creature. But on stage, we're able to really look at the truth of the character. And I know in our most recent production that Green Tea did towards the end of last year, we spent a lot of time talking about why is this relevant today, this political climate, these women who were behind the writing of this book, Wollstonecraft and her effect on Shelley and how that comes through in the book. And as a female-led organization, how can we bring that without changing the story a little more to the fore? And how do we impact and impart the meaning of the book to people with the limitations of stage? And when you think about it that way, I think you get a closer representation of the book more often than not.
And this reminds me, Heidi, of something that's disturbed me in the book very often, which is the destruction of the female creature that Victor yes. has gone to England to make, because he's brought, as he says it, he's brought this wretch into the world who is so desperately lonely. They meet and have a conversation high in the Alps when Victor comes home after having been away at college. And the creature begs him to make him a mate. And so Victor finally agrees. But then he's partway through this task, and he's worried about a race of beings. Mm-hmm. And he destroys the female creature in the process of being made. And yeah. We can see why he does that, because how would they reproduce? I don't know, but conceivably, you know, he knows the elixir of life. Mm-hmm. He's imbued this creature with it. But that I have always found so disturbing. I understand why, but that it's the female creature. And, of course, in response, what does the creature do? Kills Victor's right. wife on the wedding night. Mm-hmm. So the females don't come off too well in the book. And that has always been disturbing to me.
And I've always thought it was interesting, too, because, in fact, the act of creation is a profoundly feminine thing, mm-hmm. right? So Victor's trying to figure out how to do what women have been doing since humans have existed. Good job, Victor. Mm-hmm. You know, he's doing it in a lab, but honestly, you know, he's not doing anything we haven't thought about. And the removal of the feminine, I think, is really powerful, and it speaks to the times that Mary lived in. When she first published the book, of course, it didn't have her name on it, but it did well. And then she put her name on it, and then it did poorly because, you know, still woman in that time. So I wonder how much is a commentary on her need to tell the story and a commentary on her view of her place in the broader story.
It's probably coincidental, but it's meaningful, I think, that in a moment again where we're talking about an empowerment for women and women's voices, that we come back to contemplate the novel again through that. Mm-hmm. So I'm really glad mm-hmm. we've mm-hmm. added that to this part mm-hmm. of the conversation. Also want to say in the minutes we have left that this is my chance to understand why the action goes to the Arctic, which is something that has always seemed so weird to me. Mm-hmm. But I think what you all know is that in this era, something disruptive was happening to the climate, and there was discussion, Juliet, about what was happening in the Arctic. I didn't know that.
Yes. Yeah, so the Arctic was a hot topic when she was working on the book.
Huh.
A hot topic, yeah.
Yeah.
and it was indeed, because there was melting happening. So there was sea ice was melting around Greenland, and there was a lot of interest in figuring out whether there would be a way to sail to the north of North America. So this was the Northwest Passage that people had been seeking for quite some time. This would really shorten routes to Asia. And so the hope was they could find a route through the sea ice over Northwest or Northern North America.
Mm-hmm.
And the melting suggested that this might happen. And so there were explorers that were going out to check this out. It was in the newspaper. So this was a topic, the Arctic exploration, was something people were very interested in, and it was particularly in the newspapers around this mm-hmm. time.
Mm-hmm. So, Jennifer, this has never seemed weird to you that the action moved to the Arctic. I mean, this puts it in some context, but...
Well, but not for reasons of Arctic exploration, but because it's cold. And cold and lonely, and it seemed to me that both Victor, the doctor, Frankenstein, and the creature, we actually don't know that the creature perishes. We don't know that.
I guess that's right.
The creature says, I'm going to put myself on a pyre and burn myself up, you know, so that no one will have the misery that I have, and I won't inflict more misery on others. This is part of what, in a way, redeems him, this final speech he makes. But then he dashes off across the ice.
Right.
So you really don't know what happens, but it's cold and he's alone. And I have always found that so evocative, that the story is three nested stories. On the outside is are letters that the explorer, the captain of an exploring vessel, is writing back to family members. And he has discovered Frankenstein, Dr. Frankenstein, on the ice.
Mm-hmm.
Frankenstein has been on the ice pursuing the creature because he wants to destroy the creature. The creature's running away. Frankenstein is on essentially his deathbed. He's brought aboard the ship. And then he relates his tale, which is the next of the three tales. He relates to the ship captain who writes letters about his tale. And in his tale, Frankenstein relates the center, which is the creature's tale. And then it works its way back, the story works its way back out to the Arctic again, to the very end. And so that The aloneness, the coldness is the opposite of the passion with which Victor created the creature. It seems to me to veer very far to the other side, not even just to peace of mind, but to the complete absence of passion, in which dispassionately, we guess, the creature will take his own life, perhaps. We don't know. He's lost in the mists as he runs across the ice. But we do know that Victor dies. He dies there in the ship, not alone, but in the cold in the north.
Why do you think she left that ambiguous, the true end of the creature?
Well, doesn't every good story suggest that something might happen afterwards?
There wasn't going to be a sequel here.
Well, you never know.
Well, there is some discussion about the very last lines of the book, because as it stands, the sort of authorized 1818 text, apparently Shelley, Percy, changed the last paragraph and talks about the monster being lost in the mists. And what Mary Shelley had written was, "We lost sight of him." And so some critics have said there's a difference. To lose sight does not say that he's actually lost.
Right.
Whereas to say he's lost in the mist or whatever does say he's lost, and does suggest that he died and expired.
Jennifer, will you open your book
and
just read the last couple of lines of it?
Yeah, I just looked at it. So he's just given the speech saying that he's going to ascend his funeral pyre triumphantly. He will exult in the agony of the torturing flames. His spirit will sleep in peace. He sprung from the cabin window as he said this, upon the ice raft which lay close to the vessel. He was soon borne away by the waves and lost in darkness and distance.
Yes.
Which is
kind of ambiguous.
Mm-hmm.
Rightly so. Perfect.
I wish there is an edition of this book that has taken out all of Percy Shelley's edits and additions, because he did do some editing, and there is an edition that's just her words. Mm-hmm. It would be wonderful to have that with us.
This is not. Yeah.
Yeah. And that edition, it's fascinating because her prose is so much more direct.
Mm.
I actually think it's probably more pleasant to read, and it's just much more direct. A lot of the flowery language that I think readers today have probably difficulty with is not there.
Hey, thank you all for I told you off air this is going to be one of my favorite roundtables of 2018. Thank you. This was a fantastic discussion. Good
thank
to have you,
so
you here.
Thank you.
And head to the Bakken for a day of celebrating Frankenstein and for the ongoing exhibit.